Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavior Health Integration episode. Today, I have the great pleasure of having the president and CEO of Hazelden Betty Ford Graduate School, Kevin Doyle. Myself and Kevin will be getting into many different types of conversations on this show, from Kevin's personal experience on entering the field and the issues we are having in the mental health addiction field workforce, certain changes we can make in the counseling programs as it comes to prerequisites and additional classes added. We will get into graduate level gatekeeping and what that process looks like for the student as well as for the professors. I cannot begin to tell you how excited I am for this episode. So without further ado, let's get started. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a lot of knowledge and I cannot wait to learn from you.
Well, thanks. You're very kind. I hope I've accumulated some knowledge over the years, but we're all always learning, and I know I am. Maybe we can learn together.
Amen to that. I just have to ask you, what originally got you involved in the field? What motivated you?
Well, I come from a family that really emphasized helping others. And so all of us, one of four children, and everyone has gone into a helping profession, whether it's teaching, counseling, nursing. My parents both were teachers at one point in their different career journeys. And, you know, I think that in our family, that was a value, is using the gifts that you've been given to help others. And so the job really wasn't to figure out what to do. It was really how to do it. You know, how can I serve other people in a way that's fulfilling and ideally something that I would be good at? And so it's led me to a combination of counseling and teaching and really now in administration.
Okay. Did you ever think you'd be where you are today, or did you think you'd just be a therapist, private practice, and so forth?
I don't know. Everybody has dreams, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was to have been told years ago that I'd be a college president, I would say, wow, I hope I have a nice box at the football stadium for the for the games, or a luxury suite for the basketball games. And so, you know, it's funny how that works. So we don't have those things at our school. Yeah. I've always gravitated toward leadership positions. So I wouldn't have been shocked, I guess. But the family is from the East Coast and all of my family is in Virginia. So if you had told me I'd be in Minnesota, I probably would have been surprised about that.
And when did you first get the position at Hazelden as the president?
I started here in January of 2021. So during the end of 2020, was going through the process. I had applied for the dean position. Okay. And my predecessor retired later that year. So in the fall of 2021, I was the interim. And then in January of this year, 2022, was named to the position permanently. So I've been in the president role since that time.
So tell me your feelings on that. Were you like nervous, excited, up for the challenge?
All of the above, of course. Yeah. You know, it's a really changing time in higher education. So there's plenty to be nervous about. And sometimes people say to me, well, what are your goals for the school? And one of the first things I'll say is survival. And, you know, they'll kind of laugh. But in higher ed right now, it's really rapidly changing. There's a book that's really spot on called The Great Upheaval. People are questioning lots of assumptions about higher education. Do I really need to go to an undergraduate institution for 4 years? You know, does everybody need the same amount of time, even though people might start from different places? And, you know, we've always had things like advanced placement credits, and sometimes people move through more quickly, but everything really now is being re-examined. On the undergraduate side, when there's low unemployment like there is now, a lot of folks are able to get good jobs and may not feel the need for academic training. And then at the graduate level, things are changing as well. Maybe not quite as much because a lot of professional credentials, like for counselors, are tied to having a master's degree. So so that's still going to be in place, I think, for a while. But, you know, all those emotions that you mentioned, you know, are certainly part of it. But excitement is probably the number one emotion because I just really feel privileged and fortunate. As you get toward the end of your career, which I'm approaching, I guess, to be able to see the folks who will do the work when you no longer are younger people, you know, and the enthusiasm that they bring, it gives you a lot of hope for the future. And so that really sustains me, and is one of the most rewarding pieces of this.
Yeah. And I think you made a great point on people trying to pursue, okay, do I want an undergrad? Do I want a graduate school? And another important thing to consider is like the student loans that are out there. I personally, I'm just going to shout out right now, I have six figures in student loans, and it's something to think about.
It's a really, really significant thing for folks. And so, you know, we run into it when people are thinking about coming for a graduate degree and they say, gosh, I still have undergraduate student loans. And that's a very real consideration. We're very, very fortunate that we have a number of very generous donors who have established scholarships at our school, which is pretty unusual at the master's level. And so we do have scholarship funds available. We have a tuition reimbursement program for our employees. People who work for Hazel and Betty Ford, who may be at the bachelor level, can come to school with us and have a 75% tuition reimbursement. So if they have to take on any loans, those would be minimal. And then we've even started a new program for our graduates. If they come to work for Hazel and Betty Ford, there's a loan repayment program that's really generous. So we are really trying hard to be very cognizant and aware of what you said. And that is that student loan debt is a huge burden for people. And it's a huge obstacle to people coming back for graduate work. And so each year we're looking to add more ways that the financial burden on our students will be less. And then there are federal programs, which are really cool, that are loan forgiveness programs. If you go to work in an underserved area or with an underserved population, there are federal programs across the health professions and counselors included that will forgive your loans. And so some of our students choose to take advantage of those. We have one alum who's north of the Arctic Circle working with indigenous communities up there, loves the work. He's established an internship program for our students, but he originally went up there because of the opportunity for loan forgiveness. So even though it's expensive to go to graduate school, there are some options that folks can pursue. And I've just named four of them right there that can help with that. But it certainly is something we're really aware of.
You know, it's funny when I talk to other people who have thought about grad school, but have decided to stay, let's say, in LADC, they again will bring up, yeah, it's more financial. And I have a good career as a licensed alcohol drug counselor. I'm a manager. I make decent money, and they're happy and content with that.
Yeah, and I understand that. I'm a big fan of trying to get the maximum credential that you can have. It gives you the most flexibility. So tell those folks at the LADC level, come talk to us, because we'd love for them to come and finish out the 60 credits you need for full licensure independent practice in Minnesota called an LPCC. Yep. You know, we have plenty of folks who do have the LADC and then come on for the additional work to get the LPCC.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't really have a traditional undergrad. My undergrad was in exercise science. Mm-hmm. Yep. And when I made the decision to go into counseling, I'm not going to lie, I thought about just getting the LADC certificate. But then I thought to myself, you know, I got to think long term, and me going for my master's and getting the LPCC and the LADC is going to do so much more for me career wise than just an LADC would.
I agree with that. It opens the most doors possible. You know, it's one of the reasons I got a doctorate, because, you know, at the end of the day, I didn't want someone to say to me, you don't have the credentials needed. Now, they might not like me, that's fine, but I don't want the credential to be the thing that prevents me from doing what I want to do. And so in counseling, I think having the highest level of licensure, independent practice is the best route to go, recognizing that, you know, obviously people have obstacles and realities in their life. But, you know, certainly in my position, I'd be a big fan of doing that.
I have to ask your personal opinion on something. For the past 2 or 3 years, or maybe even longer, there's been a rumor on I don't know if it's the government or policies or procedures, but they want LADCs to have their master's degrees. So they're going to make it like a, just like a main thing where it's just like, you need your master's in addiction counseling to practice. Have you heard of that before?
I've only heard vague rumors of it. I'm fairly new to Minnesota, so in my home state, there isn't an equivalent to the LADC. There's a substance use license, but it's 60 credits, and it does require a master's. So, you know, I really gravitate toward that, with no disrespect to folks with the LADC, but the complexities that patients and clients present with now are so dramatic that I think having a really strong grounding in co-occurring disorders, mental health conditions, diagnosis is really important. And, you know, so, you know, again, just speaking for myself, the school doesn't have a specific position on this, but, you know, I see the rationale behind that thinking. Yeah.
Me personally, I'm just more confused about it all, because what does that look like in the grand scheme of things? Because, okay, you get your master's degree in addiction counseling, but you don't have your co-occurring degree, because again, there's a whole different graduate program for that. So do you just learn more about addiction in the 60 credit, you know, addiction counseling program?
That's not how I would design it. Our programs have, even though it's an addiction counseling degree, we have all the mental health components so that people can recognize and treat co-occurring disorders too. And so we're going through the accreditation process through KCREP, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. And so having all those components within the curriculum is really important. So I just don't like to see counselors who are limited saying, well, you know, you can't talk about your bipolar, or you can't talk about your depression, or you can't talk about your anxiety, because at the end of the day, we give lip service to the holistic idea. But then if we say you can't talk about certain things, then I don't think we're providing good integrated treatment. And so, so I would always support having the mental health conditions covered within the curriculum, even if it's an addiction counseling degree.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, speaking of curriculum, I'm sure your job as the president and everything, you kind of oversee that and everything. In the future, is there anything you'd want to change regarding the curriculum to grad school? I looked up some information, and I think the average grad school program is like, what, 60 to 70 credits?
60 is what most states require for licensure. So yeah, that's the most common number, certainly. Yes. And in terms of what I would change, and we're talking about this at our school, I think there's sometimes an overzealous approach to saying we need to have this, we need to have this, we need to have this, and the next thing you know, the whole curriculum is dictated and there's no choice, there's no opportunity for electives. So even in our program, I'd like to see there be more electives. We have some great elective courses: eating disorders, human sexuality, behavioral addictions, process addictions. We have a medication assisted course. Actually, we call it medications for addiction treatment. That's an elective, but our curriculum gives very limited leeway right now to our students. And I'd like to see us actually back off a little bit and not be so rigid. So if you have a 60 credit master's, I think about 51 credits would be dictated, and the other 9, which would be three credit classes, can be electives. You know, that's not to say certain things aren't important, like trauma, for example. You can cover trauma in the curriculum and not have a requirement that you have to have a 3-credit trauma course, in my opinion. You can have that as an elective. Trauma, you know, informs a lot of different things within counseling. So, and some of the other courses that I mentioned, some people would say, how can you not have a course in this? And how can you not have a course in that? The answer is you can't have a separate course in everything. So I would like a little more flexibility in curricula. KCREP and other accrediting bodies dictate certain things, but they often say, just show us where you do, where you teach this. You don't have to have a course in it, but where is it covered in your curriculum? So I'm a big fan. Students are investing in this time financially and, you know, in their lives. And so I like that they have a little bit of say in what they would like to focus on. Another good example is adolescence. You know, I spent my early part of my career working with adolescents. I have a real passion for that work. I'm not sure I'd be good at it anymore at my age. But, you know, what a valuable service to society working with young people, you know, and if you can get them back on track. I don't think any states require a course in adolescent treatment. You know, and I understand why, but I would love the flexibility for those who want to work with adolescents to take a couple courses in that, you know? So
that's so funny you said that, because I know in one of my grad school classes, the professor is like, if anybody wants to work with kids, please do, because they're the most underserved population, the ages of 0 to 5 when it comes to therapy.
Oh, yeah. And I never took a class in working with children that young. But yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been involved in counselor licensure for a number of years. And, you know, who would be the best people to have a private practice and working with young children? And a lot of times that would be school counselors. And we sometimes make it hard for them to get credentials like an LPC or an LPCC. Yeah. Well, there aren't very many counselors who feel comfortable working with young children, 0 to 5, even probably most of all, but even 5 to 12. You know, I don't have the training to work with an 8-year-old. I don't know what a sand tray is. I mean, I know what it is, but I don't know how to use one. I wouldn't really know how to provide that service. And yet those incredible counselors who work in school systems, they're the ideal people to have, you know, maybe a part-time private practice, or after they retire, they could have a private practice working with children, because parents are just desperate for help for their kids.
Yes. Through my experience, a few classes that I wish were in my program at Adler. Again, I love Adler, don't get me wrong, but I wish we would have had a class on business and private practice, which I know some other grad schools do. We just didn't at the time. And who am I kidding? Maybe they do it now. I don't know, but they just didn't have it when I was there.
Yeah, it's another great example. It's really, really hard to fit that into the curriculum. At my previous institution, I taught a class in supervision, and I did a couple of the class meetings were focused on sort of the management of a private practice and the financial pieces. So it's hard to carve out a whole class just in that, but a whole course just in that. But if you have a couple class meetings where you talk about money, you know, and how do you establish your hourly rate, and do you establish an LLC, and you have to know a little bit about the business world. I knew a counselor once who was charging a really, really low rate. And she said she had a really long waiting list. And I said, well, I think that's because your rate's too low. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, when you take out taxes from that hourly rate that you're charging, you're hardly making any money at all. And, you know, just even to keep the doors open. And, you know, I want counseling to be accessible. But if a counselor can't make a living, then the doors are going to shut. So you have to have a good business sense to you know, have a reasonable chance to keep the practice open and thriving. Otherwise, you won't help anyone, you know.
Well, do you think you can make at least a 1-credit class? I think you could. I think you can do like a little 1-credit class.
Sure. I might have to go back and talk to my faculty about that after.
God, I would love that. I would go back to grad school for that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That's a good follow-up. See, I told you I would learn something for being on this podcast, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there was another discussion on this in my past episodes about, like, fixing the mental health system. And one of the individuals I was, like, doing an interview with, she mentioned how important it would be to have, like, a politics-related, like, class in grad school where it's learning about how do counselors band together to get more money from, like, the government or whoever, again, is in charge of that. What do we have to do? How do we protest? How do we go about that? And what are some political aspects we're going to have to know about to, again, band together to fix this system?
Yeah, exactly. And that would fall under the broad heading of advocacy. And I think we are, as counselors, not particularly effective as advocates. We often apologize for ourselves and have a hard time standing up for ourselves. And in fact, there's a funny thing earlier in the podcast, Jacob, you said you use the word therapist, and I don't use that word because I feel like it's really important for us as counselors, those of us who are counselors. Now, obviously, social workers, psychologists, other professions might use the word therapist, but I really try hard to use the word counselor because a lot of people will say things like, "I'm not really sure what counselors are. What do you do?" And every time we interact with a member of the public, and we can use that word counselor, that helps people understand what this profession is and what it does.
Yeah. And I wonder if the confusion is based on, like, there's so many counselors that are not even considered mental health, but like the camp counselor from the YMCA, it gets misinterpreted, right?
That's right. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. You made a lot of really good points. Another really strong aspect I want to get into now is the scary word of gatekeeping.
Right.
I feel like there should be a dun dun dun. Would you mind telling my listeners what is this thing called gatekeeping and what goes involved or what's involved in that process?
Well, I'd be happy to do that. Gatekeeping is an ethical responsibility that counselors and other professions have, and that is to make sure that people who are either entering the profession or are in the profession are being coached and trained and supervised appropriately so that they're not at risk of doing harm to clients or patients. And so traditionally you think of gatekeeping as part of the academic arena. So while someone is in a training program, like a master's program, in addition to the grades that you get in your courses, there are things referred to as dispositions or behavioral measures. Those have to do with communication and self-care and how you interact with people, things like that. And if a supervisor or a counselor educator has a concern, then gatekeeping is one of the options that can be utilized. I was just looking at the American Counseling Association, ACA code earlier this morning, because that's what I do on Saturday mornings. No, I was just reviewing that in preparation for the podcast. And there's another word that's used in that section of the code, and that is remediation. And so it's important not to jump right to gatekeeping. You know, gatekeeping means closing the gate. You can't come into the profession. But before you get to that point, you need to have some interventions, some remediation, some corrective action, and try and help somebody. Listen, you know, if you're having some difficulties in this area, here are some things that we would suggest you do to strengthen those skills. And, you know, sort of the obvious one might be personal recovery status. If someone is a person in recovery and they're, whether it be from a mental health disorder or a substance use disorder or both, and they're really struggling, then you might need to go back into treatment or back into counseling to get your life sort of, you know, in order that you're able to be present for clients. And we owe that to our trainees. We owe that to our students, not just to say, you know what, we don't think you can cut it. The question I would ask, and I've been involved in the ethics committees for licensing boards and for professional associations, is to the supervisor, well, what did you do to help this person be successful? You know, did you give them not so much a treatment plan, but some guidance around why don't you do the following things? And I've seen some really new students who had some challenges in their lives, but if they had good faculty mentors who gave them some suggestions and they followed those, they were able to be really successful. And you know, so gatekeeping is to me almost really the last resort. Remediation should happen first, and that should happen multiple times before we even consider a gatekeeping response.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I've already learned so much from you, because I just have always had the notion of gatekeeping as, okay, you see problematic behavior, let's say in the classroom, and how the student interacts with the professor. And again, that could be an example. And then after a while, a bunch of professors just get together and be like, hey, this isn't going to work out for the student. We'll bring the student in and say, hey, I'm sorry, we're going to have to remove you from the program and so forth.
Yeah, that should be a last resort. There should have been corrective action, documentation, opportunities for improvement and remediation well before you get to that gatekeeping point.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I had this fellow student in my class, and almost every day, we would like work on like assignments together, me, her, and another student. And almost every time, she would break down crying in the middle of the assignment. And one of my fellow grad students would be like, oh, it's okay. And she would like hug her and stuff. And again, this is in the middle of the class when we're separating in groups.
Yep.
And she'd constantly break down crying. And I want to empathize with her and everything, but it's just like, you know, obviously like she needs help.
And I could definitely think like that would be a gatekeeping part of the process where maybe a teacher would do what you said and said, hey, let's try to work on this.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly people are attracted to the profession of counseling, some people, because of help that they received, you know, in their lives. And when they overcome those issues, get into recovery, you know, are functioning better, and they think about the person who was there to help them, they might say, you know what, I'd like to do that kind of work too. And so part of the counseling profession, certainly you see that dynamic. And I think that's a great thing. On the other hand, not everybody is cut out to do this work. It is hard. It is stressful. You know, it's tough when you bring it home with you, you know, at night, as they say, and can't let it go. And so there are some folks who might just be suited for something a little bit different. I would rather see that screened out at the admission point, you know, than when somebody's two-thirds of the way through their master's program. But you can't always tell. So so at the end of the day, there's nothing more important than patient and client safety. So we do have to do that. You know, as I said, I've sat on licensing boards and we have had to impose disciplinary sanctions, including revoking someone's license. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't like to do that, but if a person has demonstrated that they're going to cause harm, you're left with really no other choice, you know.
Yeah. And when I have talked to other professors, they said the exact same thing where they want to do that process sooner than later, like you mentioned. Sure. Could you elaborate more like on the admission process? Is that more like the initial interview to get to the grad school program?
Right. Every school does it in its own way. You know, so there are interviews. Sometimes there are individual interviews with faculty members. I think some programs use group interviews where you have an interview with a faculty member, and then you also have a group session with other students just to kind of see what your interpersonal skills are like. Some programs require standardized tests. I think that's becoming less and less common, but over the years that's been used as one measure, grade point average. You know, as you said, exercise science being your undergraduate major, mine was American studies. I never took a single psychology course. So I think to expect someone in the traditional college age range of 18 to 22 to know, you know, what they're going to do in their career is unrealistic in many cases. At our school, the average age is 42. So these are students who may have gotten a bachelor's degree over 20 years ago, sometimes 30 or even 40 years ago. And so we don't have a undergraduate major requirement. There's usually an essay that, you know, is intended to make sure that a person has reasonable writing skills and kind of what your motivation is for entering this profession. There isn't, you know, a right or wrong answer to that, but you should at least have a sense of, you know, why do you want to do this work? It's difficult. It's challenging. And usually it's a desire to be of help to other people. That's sort of the most common answer. The other thing I'd add, Jacob, and you and I didn't talk about this before, but we really are reassessing what we require at our school and learned recently that there's actually no requirement for people to be in a master's program that you have to have a bachelor's degree. That's the decision of a school. And so we have a work group currently functioning to look at, are there ways that someone could demonstrate to us that they are prepared for master's level work that aren't the traditional bachelor's degree? Military service, for example, if you've served in the military for 20 years and have led people who report to you, you've had lots of training, you're good, you have good writing skills, perhaps that might translate. What about someone with an associate's degree who's worked in a treatment program for 10 years, you know? Yep. Would that be equivalent to a bachelor's? So it's, as I said earlier, a really interesting and changing time right now in higher education. And we're starting to think about some of the assumptions that we've made over the years might not necessarily be valid currently. And so nothing to announce formally yet, but we're engaging in that conversation internally to see if we're going to stick with our bachelor's degree requirement or maybe have some alternative pathways that people could pursue a master's degree.
I think that's actually really cool. And piggyback off of that too, there's actually been a lot of research displaying that it does not matter what your education is. There's nothing to actually determine how good of a therapist you'll actually be. It doesn't matter if you have a master's, PhD. There's no like indicator. I think some research has even proven like the more education you have, like PhD, hinders your ability to give therapy. I don't know how much research was done on that, but
Oh, I've certainly seen people at the doctoral level who I don't think have the people skills, not so much in counseling, but just in academia in general. You know, researchers, for example, you want them doing research studies, but I'm not sure they'd be good at the personal interaction of being a counselor. So it's a really interesting project that we've embarked upon, and you know, it's going to go into 2023 before we make any decisions, but we're looking at that.
Yeah. And just to ask one more question about the gatekeeping process, have you ever been a part of those like bad situations where, you know, you've given the student opportunity to hopefully make some improvements, but let's say they're 2/3 done with their program and you have to pull the trigger or pull the plug, let's say.
Yeah, I don't think I've personally been a part of one like that. I remember in my own master's program many years ago, there was a student who was struggling and the faculty went through the gatekeeping process and he was no longer in the program. I've often wondered what happened. They did a good job of protecting his privacy and confidentiality. So we didn't know, you know, what was going down basically, other than he was no longer in the program and we had no right to know. That was his own privacy. So that was when I was a student in my career and on the academic side. Fortunately, the ones that I've been involved with have been much earlier. I remember one student at my previous institution, it was the first semester, and within the first week or two, it was pretty clear that this just wasn't going to work. And I forget exactly what the specific details were, but we really felt a responsibility to communicate this early. Because as you know, in most colleges, you can get your tuition money back if you withdraw from the class early in the semester. Yeah. But as you go, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks, you get a less percentage back. And we had enough concerns about that student that it was very clear early on. And I think it was soon enough, even within the first 8 days, that the student was able to get all the tuition money back. So no one likes to talk about money, but this is expensive, you know, and people are making a financial investment and you want to be fair to them.
And they want to, again, be able to use their knowledge and experience and degree because, again, they go so far. Now, I want to ask it about another scenario. Let's say you do that to a student, but he says, all right, whatever, screw you guys. I'm going to go to, let's say, Bethel. Like, is there anything stopping him from going to, let's say, Bethel's counseling program? Like, would you guys communicate with other schools about him or?
Yeah, no, I'm not aware that there's a whole lot of that. I think that each school, you know, has its own autonomy and can make its own decision. So I've never heard from another academic institution or ask for feedback from another. So that's a great point because, you know, if somebody is behaving unethically in a treatment program and goes for a job, you would think that each program would talk to each other. But if a person didn't put it on their resume, you might not even know they worked there, you know? So there are some gaps in the system, I think, and you've maybe pointed one out, but ultimately maybe the second program might be a better fit, you know, so you want to be respectful of that too.
Absolutely. Now I have some questions regarding the workforce issues, and I'm very excited about this because I know we can go in a lot of different directions with the field. The outlook, could we both agree, is very good for like mental health, addiction counselors, and so forth?
Oh, yeah. We can certainly agree about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what are the issues? What are, in your opinion, what are the problems we're having right now in our field?
Well, right now, it's hard finding people who want to do the work, you know, because as I said, it's hard. I mean, at Hazel and Betty Ford, we have a lot of openings right now. So it's difficult to find the workforce that's needed. I think historically, the helping professions have not been what we might call highly compensated. So people have to do this more for the value of the mission, for the you know, rewards that you get in doing this kind of work. But I don't think it has to be either or. There's no reason why we can't pay people a reasonable wage to do the work and they can have a decent lifestyle. And so, you know, and the same goes for teaching, same principle. You know, it's hard to find teachers, you know, it's hard work. We have a daughter who's a teacher and, you know, they're reasonably paid, but it's tough. It's tough work. And you got to have a really good school system, good principal and all those things and good colleagues. So same thing's true in the health professions in general, but in counseling specifically. So there are more jobs than there are applicants right now. The economy is strong. People have options. But the outlook, I think, because of things like the opioid epidemic, greater awareness of mental health issues, people are now coming forward for treatment because it's not as stigmatized perhaps to do that as it was, it still is highly stigmatized, but we've made some progress. And so people are now not ashamed to seek help. So the question is, as I like to say, who will do the work? Job security is, I don't think, the issue. It's more around compensation and management of burnout and stress and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. And like you mentioned before, like, we have the money. Can you elaborate on that? Because we have the money, but again, treatment centers, is it the owner's fault? Is it the government? They're saying we don't have the money. There's a reason behind this.
Yeah, well, so those are very real considerations, and they're very complex. But who is the payor? You know, is it a public source of funding, government funding, like Medicaid or Medicare, for example? Yeah. Is it private insurance, a third party insurer? Is it people paying out of pocket? So it's a very complex financial environment to receive services, whether it's residential, outpatient, whatever it might be. And those dollars have to be managed carefully because the field has
The managing? Who's the person?
Exactly. And, you know, it can be abused on both sides of the equation. Both sides, you know. I like to tell the story that my first job was in an inpatient hospital treatment program for adolescents. Great job. Really enjoyed it. But the length of stay for those adolescents was 6 weeks. Automatically, no matter what, there was no flexibility based on your progress. That was an abuse on the provider side. You know, about a year and a half into that job, I was asked to open an outpatient program. And some kids were appropriate for outpatient if they had a good family support, if they had perhaps a little bit of motivation. They didn't have to go into the hospital for 6 weeks, which was really, really expensive. And so there's a reason why the funds have to be managed, and that's because providers aren't always ethical about things like length of stay. On the other hand, the payor has to be ethical too. And so I've seen insurance companies have requirements that you can't come to residential treatment unless you failed an outpatient. Wait a minute. What if you have a severe substance use disorder and you have no place to live? You're not going to be successful in outpatient. So there needs to be a middle ground where there's treatment provided based on severity, right? And there are a lot of factors that go into determining the right level of care, and it requires ethical behavior on both parties, you know, the payor and the provider. And most people are not very prepared for navigating that system. Parents trying to get help for their kids, you know, for example, or spouse trying to get help for a loved one. So it's really challenging. But you know, I don't want to imply that there are sufficient resources, because we always need more resources for these needs. Yeah. But they need to be managed appropriately and responsibly too.
You know, it's also funny that you mentioned about like insurance and getting services, and they got to do outpatient first. I'm like, that makes no sense. And it really reminds me of when I like listen to other podcasts about like other health professionals, like doctors, and they want to bill a service for their patient, and the insurance company's like, well, no, you have to do this lesser, cheaper version first of the service. And if that doesn't work, then we can maybe think about doing the optimal service. And the doctor's like, no, the optimal service is going to work. This is not going to work, but it has to be proven not to work first. Then you can do the other service.
Yeah. And that's really concerning with substance use disorder, with the risk of overdoses and, you know, ongoing use. It's you're really rolling the dice in a very dangerous way in some cases, by requiring things like outpatient treatment, when there's a clear indication based on clinical necessity for inpatient or residential treatment.
Yeah, and I can just tell you through my experience, my first job as a counselor was at an outpatient facility, and I loved it. Just the main problem was, I swear to God, like 70% of the clients needed residential, and they didn't graduate. It was horrendous.
And it's really tough with adolescents, because I think there are adults who get to a point of surrender who really have years of medical issues, financial issues, family crises, losing jobs, all the legal system involvement, that, you know, they really get to a point of recognizing they need help. It's much more unusual for an adolescent to get to that point and be asking for services at 16 or 17 years old. And yet sometimes that is what they need. And, You know, I really dispute the idea that treatment needs to be voluntary to be effective. It does not. Very few people walk into substance use treatment saying, wow, I'm so happy to be here. You know, that develops along the way. You know, sometimes it's 3 days, sometimes it's 3 weeks, sometimes it's 6 months. Yes, ultimately, the individual needs to make a decision that I need to do this. But to wait for that to be there on day one is really not appropriate.
So then what are your thoughts on clients who are on probation and they have to either go to treatment or jail?
Yeah, I'm all for going to treatment because they're not going to get what they need in jail. This is a public health issue, not a criminal justice system issue. On the other hand, there's a wonderful writer and theorist of psychiatry named David Mailey. So I want to give him credit. He uses the phrase, is the client or patient doing time or are they doing treatment? Mm-hmm. If someone's just doing time, you know, you got to give it a little time. But if they're just doing time, then, you know, you need to pivot and do something else. But if someone has that option that you described, you know, the going to jail or going to treatment, and they're given the option of going to treatment, they need to work, you know, in treatment and not just be there to avoid going to jail, you know. And so good clinicians will know how to help make that happen. And you know who's the most effective at making that happen? The other patients and clients. You know, they'll say to the newcomer, I was just like you 3 weeks ago, you know, and I realized I need to be here. And you know what? You need to be here too. That's why I love groups so much, you know, because you can hear it from a peer. You may not hear it from the professional because, you know, obviously we're going to say you need treatment because we have a vested interest in keeping the doors open you know, but when the other patients are saying this to you, they don't care whether you know, are paying for this or not. They have nothing to gain. They're just speaking honestly in terms of the power of the group. And so I've always loved that distinction, doing time versus doing treatment, you know, and you're not going to get the help you need. I mean, there are some jail-based programs. They're not that common. Most correctional facilities don't have adequate treatment resources. And God bless the clinicians who work in those facilities too, by the way. But it's unusual that someone would get the help they need in the criminal justice system.
What do you think about the approach where you're a counselor and you're working with a client who's there due to probation and they just flat out tell you, hey, I'm going to use drugs after this program. I don't care what you say or do. And the counselor takes the approach of, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to fight you on that. But they try to work on other areas of their life that could be beneficial for the client. And then maybe down the road, they use their time there as a base if they ever want to get sober.
I've seen that happen. You know, in the 12-step programs, you'll sometimes hear people say, do the behaviors, the attitudes will follow later. So would I rather have someone saying, I'm never going to drink or use again? And be dishonest about that, or have them be honest, like you described. I'm really more interested in the behaviors. If you're not drinking and using today, and you don't drink or use tomorrow, and you're not drinking and using in a couple of weeks, your life is going to probably start getting better. Yeah. And so then the counselor starts to point that out. Wow, you know, you're telling me that your relationships are better. You know, what do you attribute that to? And the person says, well, I'm a better person. The counselor might say, what about the fact that you're not using right now? Well, yeah, that probably has something to do with it too. Ding. You know, and then you start talking about that, you know, and this is all about meeting people where they are. You know, we can't be judgmental. We can't, you know, dictate what someone's going to do. You know, we might make suggestions or recommendations. Like someone says, oh, I'm not going to AA. That's, you know, whatever reason they give. And your response might be, well, let's do this. Let's have you try 5 meetings and you can choose the meeting you want. They can be on Zoom. They could be in person. Yeah. They could be women's meetings, whatever, you know, and then we'll come back and talk about that because people have preconceived notions. So you don't say to somebody, you're going to have to go to AA the rest of your life. Well, who of us will agree to do anything for the rest of our lives? You know, I'd like to exercise every day the rest of my life, but I'm probably not going to agree to do that because maybe I don't want to do it on Christmas. And, you know, I'm obviously, you know, making a point here, but, you know, so come up with something that that you and the client or the patient can agree upon. You know, I know you had a negative experience with AA. How about we try NA and see if that might be a better fit for you, or Smart Recovery or one of the other, you know, the other fellowships that are out there. So I think that the substance use treatment community has at times been lazy and looking at what are some different options for people. 12-step is a wonderful, wonderful pathway to recovery, but it is not the perfect fit for every single individual, right? And so just to have that be the only tool in our toolbox is, I would say, lazy, right? And so talking through with clients and patients, what are some other options? I've had clients over the years not want to go to 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. They tried something else, and then they said, you know what? That 12-step program wasn't so bad after all. I tried these other things and I didn't like them either, you know? But you honored the person's agency, you know, yeah. their ability to make decisions for themselves rather than speaking down to people. And I think that's important. So.
Yeah. And I think you made a good point of just being aware of what the client is saying, if you're the counselor, but being open to the fact that, yeah, not everybody's going to click with the 12 steps, because again, there's still a lot of old school counselors out there that are just pro 12 step. All they do is 12 step and that is it. And I think you're really doing a client a disservice when you're, let's say, therapy approach is like that.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to listen, you know, and, what's behind that? What was your experience with AA before? You know, and again, I love AA. It's a tremendous approach for many, many folks, you know. But, you know, some people had a negative experience. Some people experience it as a religious program. The program describes itself as a spiritual program, but it can feel religious to people. So explore that, you know, let's talk that through. Is there a way to use the language of a higher power as opposed to the word God, for example, you know?
Well, it's funny. I like doing this lecture on feelings and emotions and like detaching your thoughts and emotions from yourself, where like, let's say you're going through the 12 steps and the 12 steps saved your life. That's going to be so powerfully engraved in who you are as a person, where it is part of you. So if one person says, hey, yeah, I don't really like the 12 steps or whatever, that individual, especially counselors, will take it as in, I don't like your recovery. I don't like you, when they're not really saying that, but you're taking it that way because it is so ingrained in you.
Yeah, it's very personal. And yeah, exactly. So our training should address those issues. And I love talking about those things in the classroom. I'm in an administrative role now, so I don't get to be in the classroom as much. But I keep telling our faculty, you know, invite me to come do a guest lecture and I'd be happy to fill in here or there. So
how badly do you miss it?
I miss it. Yeah, I do. The interaction with students is what a lot of us, you know, really were drawn to in the first place. But mm-hmm. I do. We have a tremendous faculty at our school, and I know they're doing great work. I read their course evaluations, and the students are getting what they need. So it's my time to use different skills to help our school and to support the faculty. But yeah, you're right. I do miss it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I do want to backtrack a little bit about like going into, let's say, residential, intensive outpatient. Do you think a lot of responsibility falls on the actual assessor and doing a good job?
Yeah, assessment is really tricky. It's challenging because, I mean, a lot of times you're reliant upon what the client or patient tells you. And, you know, until there's some trust, it's hard to get. I don't know if anybody ever got 100% accurate information in any assessment.
Well,
right?
Can I tell you a couple?
Sure. Yeah.
This one dude was, this gentleman was actually honest with me. So I recommend residential, and he got really upset. He's like, oh, I was freaking honest with you and you do this. I'm like, I thank you for your honesty. This is what I recommend. And he was like angry at himself that he tried to do the right thing, but he didn't get the results that he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. And, you know, I've had people say things like, well, you have to take what the person tells you and multiply it by two or three. And I'm like, well, you can't.
I've never
do
heard
that
one, but I like it.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, you wonder if you're getting the full story, but you can't assume that you're not either. You know, like in your case, the person was honest with you. So, you know, that's why sometimes drug testing can be helpful, because, you know, the person might not want to disclose having used certain things, but if they know there's a drug test at the end of the drug screen being done at the end of the interview, they might say, well, you know, and I would usually say that. I'll say, you know, I know it might be hard to feel safe here and feel like you can tell me the whole story. We do a drug test at the end. So it's probably going to be better if you disclose now something that would be positive. Otherwise, we have to come back and kind of redo this, you know. Substances. Yeah.
I had this really sad story about this mom raising her son alone in her apartment, and she just got a job, I think, at Menards or something. But she was using, I think, heroin like almost every day. Mm-hmm. And her probation like sent her to do the assessment with me. And I said, hey, you know, thank you for your honesty. As a professional, like, I have to stand by my license and whatnot, and like, I recommend treatment. And she was just distraught because she's like, who's going to take care of my son?
Yeah.
Who's going to pay the bills? And you have to empathize with the client. You have
Absolutely.
To empathize. And it's sad, but what are you supposed to do? Like,
right.
Because it's dangerous because, like, okay, now you're using every day. Now you're going to work. And then if I send you to outpatient, that's just more stress on you. What's going to happen to you or the child?
Yeah, those are very, very real and challenging situations. And there are no easy answers to that. But certainly the responsibilities of being a parent can seemingly interfere with someone getting the help that's needed. So I think treatment programs have to be sensitive to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, again, Kevin, it was such an honor and pleasure having you on the show. And to end things, what are your goals in the next 5 to 10 years? Because I know you're already doing a lot. Is there like a book you want to write or any projects you're maybe thinking about down the road?
I've always wanted to write a book. In fact, I have an outline of a book. I've done a lot of youth sports coaching, and I have a book for parents that I don't know if I'll ever have the time to finish that. But, you know, you see the horror stories of youth sports from T-ball all the way up to high school. But on the professional side of things, my goals are really focused on the school. I think I've had great opportunities personally to do lots of things. And now I want the Hadle and Betty Ford Graduate School to be really well known. And we're pretty well known in the, the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota community. But even here, people know Hazel and Betty Ford for treatment. But my job as the president of the graduate school is to help the profile of the school grow and for us to really help grow the addiction treatment workforce. It is a national, really international crisis. And over 100,000 overdeaths per year is unacceptable. You know, we have got to provide a workforce that can help people who need help and make treatment available. And so my goals then would be to help generate the counselors of tomorrow. And I have a role to play in that. Our faculty does, our donors do, who provide scholarships. And, I'd like to see people consider addiction counseling or mental health counseling in general as a viable career path. And if I can help the workforce to grow, then I will have felt successful. And so over the coming years, that's really what I'm focused on. And so if there are any listeners out there who have an interest in going to graduate school, we'd love to talk with you. As I said earlier, we have scholarships, and coming to work for Hazel and Betty Ford and taking advantage of tuition reimbursement is another way. And I'm not, we're not the right fit for every single student. So if students go to some of the other programs in the area or in the country, that's great too, because we need a workforce. We're happy to contribute to that at our school, and I know that other schools are doing the same thing. So we're all in this together to help this be a better community, a better place to live, and to enhance health. And so those are really big picture goals, but that's what I'm focused on.
And Kevin, man, that's a beautiful thing. And if you ever need any help or support, I'm here for you and everything. And yeah.
Thanks, Jacob. Well, I appreciate that. And I have a feeling I'll be calling upon you for that. So keep doing the good work you're doing with your podcast. And I've noticed some of the topics you've been covering. It's a really great contribution you're making as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And Kevin, if any of my listeners want to get a hold of you, is there a particular number, email, or website they could use?
Yeah, just go to the Hazel and Betty Ford website, and the graduate school has its own click-on button. My email address is kdoyle@hazelandbettyford.edu. The organization uses the .org, but we have a .edu for our school. And I'd be very happy to talk with anyone. Just Google and you'll be able to figure out how to find me. So always happy to talk with prospective students or people who have ideas about partnerships, whatever it might be.
Amen. Thank you.
Thanks, Jacob.
Again, want to thank Kevin for another awesome and amazing behavioral health integration episode. He was an awesome and amazing guest, and I learned so much from him, and it was a great pleasure. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates.
and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed.
All right, everyone. Until next time, have a good day. Bye.